It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time in our Food Friday segment, Lori Skelton has some different variations of a summer picnic classic, the potato salad.
First, yesterday, Governor Walker asked the state legislature to repeal the state's Common Core educational standards at the start of the next legislative session in January.
Although a bill in the state assembly aimed at repealing those standards failed last session, activists around the state and some Republicans in the legislature have continued to call for those standards to be repealed.
Here with us now to talk about his response to Governor Walker's call is State Representative Jeremy Thiesfeldt from Fond du Lac. He is the author of the assembly bill that failed last year, which was aimed at repealing the Common Core standards. Representative Thiesfeldt, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. Well, obviously, you're pleased by the governor's decision. Were you surprised by it?
Well, I guess, no, I wouldn't say I was surprised by it, because it seems that that is the direction things are heading nationwide. You can hardly go a week now without some sort of news coming up about another state that is taking measures against the implementation of Common Core. And Wisconsin started looking at it last year, although the bill that I put forward at the time last year, along with a few other legislators, was not directly seeking a repeal of the Common Core standards. It certainly was interested in the process of putting standards together in Wisconsin. That got a lot of attention, which is a good thing. And I think that rather than calming the issue down, the opposition to it has only intensified since that time.
So tell me how you came to oppose the Common Core standards and what your thinking on that is.
Well, I spent almost 22 years in a classroom before I got in the legislature. And so I'm pretty well versed in what standards are all about. And if you hear some background noise, that's because I'm at the Fond du Lac County Fair right now.
Okay, we'll keep that in mind.
But after my 22 years of teaching and I got into the legislature, I started hearing more and more from people about these Common Core standards that were coming down the line. And after some investigation on my own, I decided it was time for us to take a closer look at these standards in the state of Wisconsin, and was able to be appointed to the special committee that was formed in the assembly last year. And we held hearings around the state and put out some resolutions that we wanted to see a process in Wisconsin where all of our academic standards would be studied on a periodic basis. In other words, put it on a schedule, because I think most people would find it hard to believe that we don't have something like that already, but we don't. And that was really the bill that was rejected, was the periodic review of the standards. And what the governor called for yesterday goes beyond that. He called for a full repeal, which, you know, I think that is the right direction to take. The time frame for doing this has become much shorter than if we had started action on it last spring already, and so that makes it more challenging to try to get something else in place in time. But I do believe that it is the appropriate direction for our state to take, to have our own set of standards, and not something that is driven out of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that, because that's one of the issues that has come up. If you're going to repeal something, obviously it would have to be replaced with something else, and you mentioned that time factor there. Talk about the time factor a little bit, and talk about what you would see as a process for replacing these. Who should be at the table? Who should be having these discussions?
Well, clearly you're not going to see legislators putting together standards for the schools. That should be done by people who are directly involved in the schools. Certainly the Department of Public Instruction needs to play a role in that. But ultimately, the legislature does have a say, just like they do on anything else that takes place in the state of Wisconsin where taxpayer dollars are spent. And so that is kind of the direction we need to take on it. I would be completely comfortable with the bill that we tried to get passed last session. I think that was a very measured response. But I think that the direction the citizens of Wisconsin are headed on this is that they want to see these standards. They're tired of the talk of studying them. They want to see them repealed. And as for what to put in its place, You know, we've been using standards in Wisconsin currently. Common Core standards are only math and English language arts, which encompasses a couple different courses. But it's mostly math and English. And if we had to continue using what we've been doing for the last few years in the interim until we got something else into place, that would be fine. It would be fine if we went back to the previous math and English standards that we've been using in Wisconsin. But ultimately, this is a direction we need to head, because I believe that the state of Wisconsin is best served by standards that are put together by and for specifically students in the state of Wisconsin.
Heard from some of your colleagues in the news this afternoon, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, saying that developing new standards now will be very difficult. It sounds like he's willing to take a look at it, but doesn't sound particularly enthusiastic yet. Heard a comment from Senator Luther Olson, who is the chair of the Education Committee on the Senate side, saying that he is not for this review either. It sounds as though that even though the governor is calling for something, that there's still a lot that's going to be a battle in the legislature.
Well, that shouldn't be surprising. It's an important issue. And we knew it was going to be a battle last time, and it's a battle all over the country. But where I do believe that we are looking at the future independence of our schools in the state of Wisconsin. Do we want schools that are essentially driven by standards that are coming out of Washington, D.C.? Because as we know, it's pretty hard to dispute the fact that anytime you're going to allow involvement coming out of Washington, D.C., that involvement only grows over time. It doesn't get less. And so we have to understand that that is what's going to take place. I think that we know better here in Wisconsin. We have plenty of sharp people in place who can come up with a good, solid set of standards that aren't going to be tied down by the Department of Education in Washington, D.C.
Now, as you look ahead to the January session, what are you going to be doing between now and then to try to build support for this? I mean, it's a long way, and there's an election in the middle here, so there's a lot of other things going on. Is this just going to get lost in the shuffle?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that one of the problems that we've had in schools, not only in Wisconsin but across the nation, is that less and less we have not had parental involvement in our schools. You think back 30, 20, 25, 30 years ago, even beyond that, parents were directly involved in almost every aspect of our schools, and that is not so much the case anymore. And so what was unusual about this whole process nationwide is that this has been driven by parents who have stood up and said, we are concerned about this, we don't like the direction it's headed, and we want it to be changed. And those citizens, just common everyday people who are taking control of their schools and their children's education, they are the ones who have brought this to the legislators and said, and pressured them to say, you know, we got to do something about this, and the legislators have responded. You know, that's what we're supposed to do, is respond to what people say, and I believe, after my studies and my years of experience, that there is a better direction to go on this.
Well, Representative, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Have a good day.
Yeah, and enjoy the fair. We've been speaking with Assembly Representative Jeremy Thiesfeldt from Fond du Lac. During the last legislative session, he authored a bill aimed at reviewing the state's Common Core standards. And yesterday, Governor Walker called on the state legislature to repeal those standards. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Summer is full of barbecues and picnics, and that usually includes some classic dishes, including potato salad. And by the way, the humble potato salad has gotten some headlines lately after a Kickstarter campaign crowdfunded about $50,000 in pledges to make a batch of this stuff.
Man, for $50,000, I would have made a batch
of
this stuff. Well, we've got good news, because we've got lots of potato salad in the studio. Lori Skelton is with us right now, and we're going to be talking about some of the different iterations of this classic dish, and we don't even have a Kickstarter campaign here.
No.
Lori is one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Now, I've got to give one caveat. We decided to do a show on potato salad today when the Kickstarter campaign was only at $5,000.
Wow.
So, but
so we were ahead of the curve.
Well, here's the thing. of all the Food Friday segments that I've looked into, this had to have been the most contentious. I didn't post a recipe today. I posted some suggestions, but there is no one way to make potato salad.
So if you want to start a fight, start talking potato salad.
I mean, don't even get me started on the do you use mayonnaise or Miracle Whip. When I met the woman who insists on half and half, it's like, okay, we're just. And for me, potato salad is something really special. My mother makes a basic American potato salad. She doesn't add a lot to it. I have actually stood next to her in the kitchen, duplicated her movements, potato by mayonnaise, by egg, and I can never get my potato salad to taste like my mother's. Mm. It's the one thing she can just throw it together. It's perfect every time. I try to write down a recipe, and I just flop.
And as you say, there are lots of variations on this. We were talking before, and you kind of call potato salad a blank canvas.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Besides the fact that everybody has their own way of doing it, you're working with a starch. So you've got something that can take on so many different flavors. If you want it hotter, people suggested sriracha or jalapenos. If you want it milder, you up the amount of mayonnaise you're using, or you use something like sour cream in your basic American potato salad. And then, of course, you've got things like German potato salad, which is incredibly popular
German
in Wisconsin.
Mm.
This is a potato salad that should be served hot. Unlike American potato salad, which you can pull right out of the refrigerator, this you really have to put together at the last minute. But it's such a marvelous accompaniment, especially if you decide to play around with the vinaigrette, maybe omit the bacon or use less because you know you're going to be serving it alongside certain sausage products that maybe don't need it.
Now, Lori, we'll get to the samples you brought in just a minute. A lot of times lately you've thrown in some secret ingredients into things like miso and dessert. This time the secret ingredient is just potato.
Because I use three different kinds of potato for the three different kinds of salads we've got.
Ooh,
For the basic American salad, I discovered that especially if you're wanting to watch your weight, you'll want to use a little less mayonnaise, but you still want a creamy potato salad. So use a russet potato. These are going to cook up a little bit mealier. They'll actually fall apart as you're blending the salad together, so that will add to the creaminess without adding to the calories.
They soak up the water kind of as you boil them and really get it into the starch there, it seems.
Exactly.
Like.
Another thing that I discovered in putting these together, it does help if whatever potato you're using, season the water. Put in salt if you're good with salt in your diet. If not, use something like a little bit of sliced onion or a bay leaf. Seasoning the potatoes while they're cooking will actually make them taste better in the salad. So that's the American potato salad. I used russets there. For the German potato salad, I wanted a potato that I could peel, but something that would have a little more stability to it, a little lower on the starch. So here I used a gold Yukon gold potatoes, excuse me, they're called. For the French potato salad, I wanted a little bit of color, and I also wanted to leave the skin on, and there I used a red potato.
Okay. Well, we've been smelling these for some time now, actually. So let's start tasting. Do you want to start American? I'm holding the American here, right?
And I threw in a little bit more than I normally do with a potato salad for American. We've got celery and celery seed in here, dry mustard powder.
Kind of tastes like my mom's.
Little bit of chopped onion, little bit of pickle relish, and a little bit of egg. What my mother does is she uses a lot more egg than I do. She also uses chopped fresh green pepper rather than celery. But I know somebody who insists it's American potato salad, even though he puts in chopped French pickles and capers.
I could see pickles in this, definitely. So I would say, I mean, looking at this and tasting it, this, if I just thought potato salad, this is what pops into my head. I think the celery, I love it in potato salad. It's got to be a key.
As I'm trying not to crunch into the microphone.
Right, that's fine. Crunch away. there's a little bit of zippiness. Is that a tiny bit. Is that just pepper or?
I always use fresh ground pepper.
Okay.
And maybe that's what you're catching.
I think that's
But I did use 3/4 teaspoon of dry mustard powder.
Mm.
So it's not bland. It's not going to blow your ears off, but there is a little bit of a kick to it. What do you think about the creaminess factor? I only used half a cup a mayonnaise in this.
I like
Gene wants more creaminess.
I do want more creaminess, but this is very good. This is very good. There's always room for more mayonnaise for me.
I would probably throw in more mayo, too.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's really good. The mm-hmm. taste is awesome. For me, I would put in a little more mayo.
All right.
But you're thinking, hey, I want to watch my weight. I don't want so much mayonnaise in there. That makes sense.
So what
sour cream? Would you do that ever?
I have. It's probably not my favorite. For me, that makes it just a tad too fancy.
Too fancy for you, Laura.
Too uptown for you, my goodness.
There are certain things you just don't want to get too snooty about. And for me, potato salad is one of them. Like I say, I have such a strong sense memory of when my mother makes potato salad. I don't want to screw it up. And the more I do to it, the more it doesn't taste like hers.
You know, and what this really reminds me of, this is great for like food on a hot day.
Yes.
It really is. It's really good that way. So, but I'm holding now what we really all came here for, and that's the German potato salad.
Yes, you told me this is your favorite.
Oh, my gosh, is it my favorite.
Now, the problem with what I had to do today is I wasn't able to actually combine all of this in a pan on the stove. I mean, this is really something you have to make at the last minute. So I cheated a little. I made the potatoes. I made the vinaigrette, which is after you've fried up your bacon, you take the bacon out, and then you've got all those lovely little crispy bits in the pan.
Yep.
You throw in some onion, and then you throw in some of the potato water from when the potatoes were cooking, and a little bit of vinegar and a little bit of sugar, and you cook that all down. And you're supposed to throw the potatoes in and let that all talk to itself. I had to do it separately in the microwave. What do you think, Gene?
Well, this is my new favorite. I love the little bacon stuff. I love everything about it.
Okay.
And are these are the onions here, right?
There are some onions in
there. It almost looks like sauerkraut.
And I did use some German stone ground mustard with just a little bit of horseradish.
Oh, boy.
Really good. Really good. What's the vinegar in here?
Just basic white vinegar. Nothing fancy. I saved the fancy for the next potato salad we're going to have.
For France land.
For France. Absolutely. Judiciaire's Poisson has been schooling me in how to make a good French vinaigrette, so I've been practicing with some of her suggestions.
Not to offend her, it's going to be hard to top the German. This is
I'm going to say the German potato salad is so unbelievably good. How are you going to top it with this French salad we've got here?
Well, with the American potato salad, you're going to want that fairly cold. German potato salad, hot right off the stove. The French potato salad, you can serve room temperature and not worry about it. This is a potato that is sliced rather than diced up. So you've got a fair amount of potato surface area. And when the potatoes come out of the water, you spread them out on a baking sheet and you pour vinaigrette over them. Use Dijon mustard and champagne vinegar. Again, a little bit of the potato water that the potatoes cooked in. It's got some starch into it, so that's going to give the vinaigrette some body. There is parsley, tarragon, and chives. If I had chervil, I would have used it. That's a lovely French herb, but I bumped up the tarragon and the parsley with this. There's also some chopped shallot and a little bit of garlic.
Go ahead.
Seems like there'd be room to play around with fresh herbs on this one. I could see making it distinctly different just by changing the fresh herbs.
And another thing that you can do if you want to play around with more green is use blanched green beans with this as well. That is going to be something that will play with a lot of different herbs. You could use thyme with that or savory. It's not exactly a straight French potato salad, but I know a lot of people do like having that crunch. And that's one thing you're missing with a French vinaigrette potato salad is something a little bit toothy.
Well, I think more celebrations in order in Germany on top of their big World Cup win. I think they win the Central Time Potato Salad Cup as well. I like all of them a lot, but I think the German has got to be my favorite of the batch. Gene?
And mine, too. I have to say we had a lot of worthy competition here today, and they were all excellent in their own way, so kudos to them. But I'm just a German potato salad fan, and so that's my starting point is there. And, you really came through today. They were terrific.
Lori, just in our little bit of time left, any other last recommendations to experiment with on our potato salad or a personal favorite?
Again, to play around with your basic potato salad, start with your potatoes. Figure out which one is going to be the best for your particular salad. One thing I didn't try, there are some wonderful colored potatoes out there, red and purple. And I know some people for 4th of July will actually take small red, white, and purple or blue potatoes and make their potato salad that way. Play around with how you season the water. And one thing, as we're talking about blank canvas, that I might want to suggest you try is upping the heat a little bit.
Okay. Well, sounds great. Lori, these are awesome. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Absolutely.
That's Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies at WPR.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell.
100 years ago, Europe was stumbling toward war after the assassination of Austrian Archduke Ferdinand. World War I saw warfare on a new scale, in some cases with tens of thousands of soldiers dying in the course of a single day of battle.
The war ended in 1918, but our next guest says the impact of that war echoed through the rest of the 20th century, and it shows up even in today's headlines a century later.
David Reynolds joins us now. He's a professor of international history at Cambridge University. His new book is The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century. David, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Rob.
So you write, looking at it on the American side of things, that World War I is the forgotten conflict of America's war-torn 20th century. Why is it largely forgotten here?
Well, the United States was only involved in it for 18 months, from April 1917 to November 1918. And it was a struggle which was eclipsed later on by the length and the magnitude of the Second World War, which is what really catapulted the United States into the realm of a superpower. But I would say that the roots of many of the attitudes and in some ways the problems that the United States has grappled with in the 20th century lie in that period around the Great War, as the British called it, the First World War, as it became. And that's why I think it casts a long shadow for America, as it does for many European countries.
Well, certainly looking at news in the headlines this week, conflict between Israel and Palestinians, a Sunni group trying to form a new country in Iraq and Syria, conflicts on the border between Russia and Ukraine. How much do these kind of problems rise from the collapse of major empires and attempts to redraw maps at the end of World War I?
Four great empires that had controlled most of Eastern and Southeastern Europe for several centuries fell apart in 1917-18. The Tsarist Empire, the Russian Empire, the German, the Habsburg Empire in the Danube and the Balkans, and the Ottoman Empire in Southeastern Europe, in the Balkans, and out into Asia Minor. So that, for example, Palestine is a creation of the period after the Ottoman Empire fell apart. It was a country that was taken, or an area that was taken by the British, was held as a mandate, as a trust from the League of Nations. But the British grappled with the problem of relations between Arab inhabitants and Jewish settlers, and that's a problem that takes us right through to the present day. The British also got Mesopotamia, which became the country of Iraq. At the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, the Kurds were asking for their own separate state. Kurds and Kurdistan is right in the headlines today, as is another country that tried unsuccessfully for independence in 1919, Ukraine. And Ukraine is right in our headlines and has been for several months. So these are old topics that are still hot news.
And part of the problem and part of the reason those maps were so contentious at the time and to this day was a concept of what constitutes a nation that arose with the post-war settlement. Can you talk about how the Great War, then World War I, changed the way we talk about nations?
Yes, these are various ethnic groups that in the days of the big empires kind of sheltered together under this large umbrella. Sometimes the treatment of the minority groups was quite tolerant. It was, for example, in the Ottoman Empire. It was to a degree in the Habsburg Empire. But during the wartime conflict, these ethnic groups developed a kind of either-or sense of identity, that you were either for the country or against it. The whole sense of national identity became much sharper, much more conflictual. And that's the kind of identity problem that we still had right down to the present day. Of course, the issue was compounded by the way that the Bolsheviks, Lenin in Russia, and then Woodrow Wilson, the American president, talked about self-determination for these nations or national groups. But exactly what was the national self, how you define the nation, that became enormously important and enormously problematic in Europe in the 1920s and 1930s. And indeed, it was those kinds of questions that laid the seeds for the next war in countries like Czechoslovakia and Poland.
Well, and it seems that you mentioned Woodrow Wilson and the Bolsheviks. In some ways, they came at opposite approaches. Wilson saying nations, ethnic groups had the right to their own country, to self-determination. Ultimately, in the Soviet Union, it seemed there was an effort to forget about nationalities as much as they could, freeze them and define the nation differently. And obviously, at the end of the Cold War, the nations, the nationalities, the ethnic conflicts were still there.
Yes, that's true. Lenin and the Bolsheviks used the concept of self-determination as a kind of revolutionary tool to encourage the breakup of the big empires. But then their conception of the Soviet Union was multinational state controlled by an overriding ideology, which, of course, was a cover for essentially Russian nationalism. It was Russia that controlled the Soviet Union. So you're right that in that sense, the question of national identity was frozen during the Soviet period. It was also frozen when the Soviet Union took control of Eastern Europe in countries like Hungary or in Poland. And then this whole debate about what constitutes a nation really opened up again after the Cold War, and we're still seeing it going on. You know, we often say, oh, the Cold War ended in 1989 or 1991, but there are ways in which the legacies of that Cold War are still with us, and as I've argued in my book, In the Long Shadow, those problems are themselves rooted in the fallout from the war in 1914-18.
We've mentioned the Bolsheviks, one obvious major change in government there from Tsarist Russia to the communist Soviet Union. You also say the outcome of World War One and that Russian Revolution changed politics in the United States and increased antipathy toward any kind of leftist politics. Can you talk about that bit of fallout?
Yes, I mean, the United States came into the war late. Woodrow Wilson was very clear in 1914 that the United States should not get involved in the conflict, that it was a European conflict pitting old world empires against each other. And Wilson was afraid that the fallout in the United States would be considerable if countries that had sympathies with one side or another or national ethnic groups that had sympathy one side or another got antagonistic towards each other. There's a lot of German Americans, a lot of Irish Americans on one side, people of British stock on another. And so Wilson wanted to keep out. Once the United States got in, Wilson and the American war effort really ratcheted up the sense of antagonism against Germany as the enemy. To persuade Americans, I think, that a war 3,000 miles away was a war that mattered to them and that they should be emotionally involved in. And I think after the war, that 100% Americanism, as it was known, carried over towards a new enemy, in this case, the sense that there was the leftist threat, the Bolshevik threat. And I think that the Red Scare of 1919, the anti-Bolshevik, anti-leftist fervor at the end of the war, which was fueled by this continuing 100% Americanism, helped to define America's sense of its own identity in enduring ways. Because what is striking about America in the 20th century compared with Europe is that the country has had no significant socialist or communist parties of the sort that were absolutely fundamental to the politics of much of Western Europe and Eastern Europe through the 20th century. And the Cold War, of course, was a reinforcement of that sense that American political values were very much to the right of center as far as the political spectrum in Europe was concerned. So I think this sort of this black and white sense of national values and national identity was something that was has been fundamental to American life through the 20th century, and it has its roots in that patriotic conviction during the First World War.
Coming out of Europe in particular, there was a sense during and after the war among many that this was a war to end war. Never again, you keep quoting people saying. Obviously, it happened again in fairly short order. But setting aside World War II, how were people thinking about the future of war and conflict after World War I?
Well, the war of 1914 came as enormous shock. You mentioned that we're in Europe particularly thinking about the centenary at the moment. Essentially, it's 37 days from the assassination of the heir to the Habsburg throne, the Archduke of Austria-Hungary, to the British entry into the war. In other words, and that's the last of the major powers involved. So it's just about a month or so, in which a crisis comes in many ways out of the blue. You can see that there are structural problems in Europe, but nobody's expecting this sort of just complete slide into crisis, confrontation, and a war that then engulfs the whole of Europe. So so there's a huge sense of shock, I think, after the war, and a lot of trying to think out how you prevent this happening again. And the whole idea of the League of Nations is really to create some kind of forum in which the powers can talk before they fight, before they get to blows. And the search for some kind of mechanism to control international relations, to control this intense nationalism, is something that's really fundamental to the 1920s and even the 1930s. But the 1920s in particular is a period where people really put a huge amount of energy into peacemaking in the United States and in Britain. There are huge popular peace movements, huge movements for disarmament, involving, to a large extent, women who have got the vote in both the United States and in Britain as a result of the war. And their energies go into saying never again, and the way we do this is through supporting some kind of international body to resolve disputes before they escalate to conflict.
We're talking with David Reynolds of Cambridge University about his new book, The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century. Coming up, we'll talk about changing ways people have remembered and talked about the First World War. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our conversation with David Reynolds, a professor of international history at Cambridge University. His new book is The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century.
And David, you write not just about the direct outcomes of World War I, but the changing ways that people have looked back on it and remembered it over in different times and in different places. How has that evolved as we mark the 100-year, I should say, anniversary of the war?
Well, one of the things I argue in The Long Shadow is that we see the war of 1914-18 through the lens of the war of in Europe 39 to 45, or for the United States 41 to 45. In other words, we see the First World War refracted through the Second War, and that's different in various countries. In France, for example, the Second World War is a national humiliation. The French army surrenders, collapses in a month. The French puppet government then collaborates with the Nazis. This is an issue which has darkened French politics for many decades in the later part of the 20th century, whereas the French look at the First World War as a noble sacrifice to purge the country of the German invader. For the British, it's kind of the other way round. We, rather like you, think about the Second World War as a good war, as a noble one, one that ends in a clear-cut victory, defeating a terrible evil of Nazism. But for the British, the First World War, which is the greatest losses in British history, military history, 750,000 dead, that is a war that we continue to puzzle over, and in public memory certainly is felt to be largely futile, a struggle of mud and blood in the trenches, getting nowhere, and in which the main illumination for British people comes not from historians or politicians, but from the war poets, which is, again, a very distinctive take on the war. So I think that in each of our countries, we see the war, the First War, through the lens of the Second. For the United States, I think the story is much more sequential, that the First World War was seen as a kind of mistake in the 1930s, but then during the Second World War is presented by the Roosevelt administration as the first stage towards America taking a decisive role in guiding world affairs. And when the State Department is running its campaign for the United Nations in the Second World War, it describes it as America's second chance to seize the reins of world leadership. In a sense, Wilson as the pioneer, Roosevelt as the man who builds on that, moving America into center stage. So for the United States, I think the First World War takes us into the Second World War, America's good war, as a rising trajectory into world power.
There's a similar story in The Economy that you tell there, where in the interwar years leading up to the Great Depression, I think you quote someone saying something like, Britain couldn't lead, America wouldn't lead the world economy. Does that legacy live on now in the U.S., playing a much stronger role in trying to guide the economy of the world?
Yeah, I mean, the First World War is fundamental for the shift in the world economy from a global economy in which Britain plays a central role to the United States playing that central role. The war turned the United States from a net debtor nation in international affairs into a net creditor nation. American banks, American public start to get used to loaning abroad, and particularly in Europe, in Britain and in Germany and so on. And then that new role is kind of brought to a juddering halt by the Wall Street crash in 1929, by the Depression. America's finances pull in. America looks into itself in the Depression. And it's argued by a number of historians that America's failure to take on that global leadership role in the world economy was part of what made the Great Depression so much worse. After the Second World War, of course, huge attempt by the United States to play a global economic role as well as the role of a superpower in programs like the Marshall Plan and so on, which is very deliberately intended to do for post-Second World War Europe what wasn't done consistently and substantially after World War One in the way of in American financial and economic commitments. So, yes, I think this is a critical time in America's emergence as a global economic force.
I also wanted to ask you how World War One changed the way we think about, talk about, and memorialize veterans of war. Very different stories, for example, in Britain versus Germany in the years after the war.
Germany. Well, the Germans never come to terms with the end of the war in 1918. The German army, remember, is still fighting on foreign soil in the West. It's still in France and Belgium when the Germans ask for an armistice, for a ceasefire. And then when they ask for a ceasefire, the shock in Germany itself, where the public has been persuaded that they're just on the verge of victory, that the shock is so profound that the whole political system collapses. The Kaiser is overthrown, a republic is declared, revolution breaks out on the streets, and Germans struggle to understand what has just happened to them in 1918, and the disconnect is explained for many people by the argument that Germany had been stabbed in the back at home, the German army had been stabbed in the back at home by leftists and pacifists and so on. This is the argument that Hitler peddles with particular success, but it's done by a lot of right-wing groups. So that for those on the political right in Germany, the argument or the contention is not never again, but if you like, bring it on. We need another round. We need to get revenge for what has happened. For the British and for the French, the take is very different. This is a huge sacrifice. The war can be justified. The sacrifice can be justified if you ensure that there isn't another conflict like that again. And those attitudes feed very much into what was known as appeasement in the 1930s, the appeasement by the British and French of Nazi Germany, in part because of this deep public feeling that war on that scale, again, is just unacceptable.
We've only really scratched the surface, but I think a big lesson from your book is, as much as World War I, the Great War, was an unintended war in many ways, war has huge unintended consequences that no one can predict when they get into them. Do you have lessons you think we could draw from that today?
Yeah, I think so. I think that many of the statesmen who went through those 37 days in 1914, in the summer of 1914, spent the rest of their lives trying to think through what exactly had happened, because the consequences of their actions were not what they expected, and were hugely catastrophic. So that, yeah, I think that it's a sort of Pandora's box, if you like, that when you open it, when you resort to war, you don't know what the consequences will be. I would say that you can see that in the intervention in Iraq 10 years ago, a conflict that was supposed to resolve a number of things in a short surgical way and, of course, has opened up a huge long conflict for the United States, for Britain and other powers, and one that is still not resolved today. And the situation in Iraq is now extremely problematic and fragile. So that going to war is a risky thing in all sorts of ways, not just because of the loss of life, but because you just don't know what is going to happen when structures, political structures, state structures are attacked and violated and changed. The fallout can be immense.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was David Reynolds. He's professor of international history at Cambridge University. We've been talking about his new book, The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.